I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about a topic that is perennial through the course of American history. It's a fascinating topic, and we are going to be talking about that topic through the lens of a wonderful book that has been written, and we'll get the chance, the opportunity today to talk with its author. Today we're going to be talking about the book Seeds of Victory, Defeat, Triumph, and the American Way of War, with its author, James Ellman. For those of you who don't know James, he is a prolific author, an independent historian, the author of a number of wonderful books, terrific reads. I know from being a political scientist and reading a lot of political science stuff, this is a lot better than that stuff. You're going to want to read these books. They are written to be read, to be digested, and to be learned from. He is the author of other books besides Seeds of Victory, including MacArthur Reconsidered, about Douglas MacArthur, the World War II American general, and working on, and hope we come out next year, Patton Reconsidered, an analysis of General George Patton and his generalship. James Ellman, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Look, this is an interesting title, Seeds of Victory, Defeat, Triumph, and the American Way of War. Americans are not used to thinking of the word defeat connected to the American war efforts. That's not how we usually think about things when we understand our history. And in the book, you make an argument that I found really fascinating, which is the way that a country fights its wars, the how, the why, the personnel, the strategies, tell us a lot about that country itself. Why is war so important for understanding the ideas, the principles that animate America as a nation?
Well, first of all, the United States is a nation shaped by war, as you mentioned. For better or worse, we've been at war for more than 220 years since our founding, the great majority. There have been very few years the U.S. has not been at war. War has shaped who we are as a nation as much as any other concept, as likely as much as democracy, as free markets, as the concept of limited government. War allowed us to break away from Britain, for better or worse, exterminate hundreds of thousands of Indians, to conquer the western half of the United States from Mexico, ended slavery, and allowed us to defeat totalitarianism in the form of Nazism, National Socialism, or communism, to continue our freedoms here in the United States. Being in the military is the best trodden path to the White House. 12 of our presidents were generals, another 6 were colonels. This compares to only 17 who are senators, 17 who are governors, wow. 15 vice presidents, and I believe 6 secretaries of state. So if you want to get into the White House, being a general has historically been the best way to get there. What has been known or come to be known among historians as the American way of war is often one that evolved to a doctrine of striving to achieve decisive, crushing victories over our enemies, using overwhelming firepower, and wherever possible, utilizing industrial might at technological advancements rather than cannon fodder and throwing men and women into the fight.
Yeah. Can we talk about that for a minute? I find that argument in your book very interesting. And it reminds me, I have a chance to teach a senior undergraduate class on Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. And in that book, he has a long section devoted to how democracies, including America, fight wars. And I'm wondering if we think about, because your book does a wonderful job sort of laying out chronologically, historically, some battles from the American Revolution into the, well into the 20th century, sort of showing how victory comes out of initial defeat or how we progress toward victory. And I'm thinking about Tocqueville's observations. And one of those, he says, is that democracy is not like aristocracy in that democracy wants to be peaceful in general, because democratic people are busy people living their lives, raising their families, running their businesses, going about their normal lives. And they're not often not ready for war, and they're not willing to fight wars until they're really riled by something. Has that been our experience? If you think about initial defeats in war, if you even take us back to the American Revolution, we tend to think of the American Revolution as a glorious series of victories. But as you lay out, it was closer to a disastrous string of defeats, at least at the beginning.
Well, certainly for Washington and the Continental Congress and the other founders of the nation, they knew very well that the British were not going to walk away from the 13 colonies and let us become an independent nation without a fight. And from the very beginning, we knew it was likely to be a long fight, and we began to cast about for allies, particularly those on the other side of the Atlantic, with France, the Netherlands, and Spain being the most likely potential allies that could provide us not only with men and ships, but also just credit and the money to fight the war. So this nation was born in battle, and it was born in the knowledge that we are going to have to fight a long war to be able to survive as an independent country.
Tell us a little bit about early defeats, because again, one of the themes of your, you know, seeds of victory, right? Defeat, triumph, and the American way of war. Tell us about these early defeats and what were some of the causes and what did we learn about them in order to turn ourselves around?
There are several common themes that you can see if you take a look at U.S. military history. And one is that we have not been this hegemonic victorious power that always wins and wins easily. We have been a nation, and I document in the book, eight different times between 1776 and 1951, where the U.S. is strategically defeated and looks like we are going to lose the war. But almost every time, or at least in all of those eight examples, and effectively there are no other examples where we've lost, the nation was able to react and recover and go on to triumph relatively quickly, if not very quickly, surprisingly quickly, which is very different than other nations that often were not able to react and change their stripes on the battlefield when they lost and ended up having to go to the diplomatic table and accept a major defeat. Specifically for an early defeat for the United States, it happened in 1776, so right in the first year of being a country. Washington, of course, was successful in driving the British out of Boston. That was a victory. And he immediately began to shift his forces down to New York because there was a great deal of expectation that New York was going to be the next target of the British attack. General Charles Lee, who eventually ended up being captured, and we don't remember his name that well, but he was a professional soldier on the American side, of course, had been British until 1776. He was sent down by Washington to New York, and he told Washington, you can't afford to lose New York, but you cannot hold it. You cannot hold it because you do not have control of the sea, and the British have control of the sea. But Washington, under pressure from Congress, decided to hold New York anyway. He could not hold the city of New York, which at the time was just the lower part of Manhattan, the south, down near Wall Street. You couldn't hold it unless you also held Brooklyn Heights. If you've ever been to Brooklyn Heights, it's right across from the East River, and you can look right down onto the ground of Manhattan, southern Manhattan. So if you had some cannons and you had those cannons, you'd be able to control what was then the city of New York. So he placed a lot of his troops in Brooklyn Heights. He placed a lot of his troops in New York. And then the Howe brothers, the British, showed up with a much larger force. Washington should not have tried to defend these areas. He had been told by General Lee not to, but he did anyway. The British landed. They defeated him in the Battle of Long Island, which was actually in Flatbush in Brooklyn. If you look at a map, Brooklyn is part of Long Island, though many people in Brooklyn today probably wouldn't want to agree with that. In any event, the Washington and his troops were defeated. He was pushed back into his fortress around Brooklyn Heights, and the British should have captured him and his army and likely ended the revolution right there in 1776. However, the wind was blowing from the north, so the British ships couldn't get up the East River. It was a nice foggy night. We had a bunch of soldiers from in his army that were from Marblehead, or from where I'm in Boston, it would be Marblehead. And they were great seamen and coastal workers, and they were able to bring his whole army across from Brooklyn Heights to Manhattan in the middle of the night, and they got Scott away. He lost a lot of men in the Battle of Brooklyn Heights and Battle of New York, Long Island, sorry, and he lost a great deal of equipment, but he still held New York, but he still should have retreated from there. He hadn't learned his lesson yet that he could not take on the British head on, and he could not take them on when they could land in his rear using their shipping, which is exactly what they did. They landed at Kips Bay, which is near where the United Nations building is now. And Washington lost a lot more equipment and some more men and was luckily able to retreat again. He fought another battle up in White Plains, where again he was got outflanked and could have been surrounded and captured. Luckily, he didn't. But this was a strategic defeat. He had lost a huge number of his troops, huge amount of equipment, and that was made even worse when Fort Washington, named after him, which is where the George Washington Bridge comes across the Hudson River, was based, and a very large garrison was forced to surrender with all their equipment there. Washington began to retreat through New Jersey, heading south. This is where Thomas Paine, the author of Common Sense, was with the army at the time, when he wrote, this is the time that tribesmen souls and the Sunshine Patriot will be with us, but the patriot that stays with us now, we will really appreciate him.
That's one of the themes of your book, clearly, the American ability to not win every battle, but to survive long enough to learn and to adapt. And you make an argument in the book that we see this consistently throughout the course of American history and American military history. Can you give us another example from the book of a time where a situation like Washington faced, we faced defeat, but there was an American adaptation, a learning that led us then to eventual victory?
Absolutely. For better or worse, and mostly for worse, the U.S. has started a lot of its wars not being prepared for the war, even though it knew it was coming, or even perhaps was asking for it to take place. For example, in the War of 1812, we thought it would be, Jefferson thought it would be nothing except a little bit of marching to take all of Canada. But we didn't have the internal navy on the Great Lakes, we hadn't raised the right army, and we were defeated badly there. We had to build a navy from scratch on the Great Lakes. We had to raise an army from scratch, and luckily we did not lose what is now called the Upper Midwest and the Old Northwest states such as Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan. Similarly, at the beginning of World War II, we were simply not ready to fight, for example, in the Philippines. We had the wrong equipment, we had the wrong strategy, and we probably had the wrong general in MacArthur, who was a man who always wanted to attack, and the concept of retreat was very painful to him. Finally, the same happened at the beginning of the Korean War. We had the wrong troops with the wrong equipment, and we were not ready, and we had to react and learn quickly to be able to win.
So one of the things, again, I'm thinking that's a remarkable thing you're saying, because it takes me back to Tocqueville's book, which was written all the way back in 1835, 1840. And one of the things he says is that democratic peoples like the Americans are not ready, and because they're not on a war footing like aristocratic countries or more hierarchical countries. You think of an imperial Japan, for example, which is a very warlike society and very hierarchical. And one of the other things Tocqueville talks about is that the difficulty for a country like America early in a conflict to find capable generals who really, and it takes time for them to be able to test and find them, and they stumble for quite a while until they find someone who's successful. But then he argues, once they find a very successful general, nothing holds them back from giving that general command, because it's not an aristocracy. They could be a low-born person, but, you know, they're very good at being a general. And then they take charge and they can really prosecute a war. Are there some examples from your book where you could think about and say, yeah, the Americans started out with bad leadership, but they relatively soon discovered some good generals and that helped the war effort?
That has taken place several times in U.S. history. A great example, of course, would just be Ulysses S. Grant, one of our most famous generals. He was living in relative obscurity in the west of the United States. He was thought of as being a failure, both in business and in the military. People were concerned that he was a drunk. But of course, Lincoln said, "I need this man. He fights." And when people complained that he drank too much whiskey, Lincoln suggested that he find out what brand he liked, so he would send a bottle to all of his other generals. And again, as you mentioned, he was not perhaps the most high-born sort of guy in the United States system, but he rose very quickly, was promoted very quickly. Next in World War II, it's amazing when you look back at it how quickly Dwight D. Eisenhower was promoted. And he went from being a colonel at the beginning of the war to a brigadier general, to a major general, to a lieutenant general, to a full general, to a five-star general. We hadn't really had those before. And George Marshall, the chief of staff of the Army, and later Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, was extremely good at picking out the right people, the wheat from the chaff, and saw that Eisenhower was going to be the right man for the job early on. And FDR agreed with that after meeting with him on multiple occasions and kept promoting him. So the United States has found a way to promote people quickly and has often been willing to fire generals very quickly. It fired and turned over its entire set of generals and the Secretary of War, that's what we called Secretary of Defense back then, in the War of 1812. We fired, I believe it's 50 different generals, were relieved of their posts in World War II. Thomas E. Ricks, in his book, The Generals, discusses this, how we used to fire generals very quickly. Now, perhaps we don't fire them or relieve them as quickly, but they tend to be rotated out of the combat area a bit more quickly if they're not doing as good a job as we would like. So the United States has been much more willing to end people's careers and be willing to accept bruises and hurt feelings and put the right men in the job.
Another thing that you've mentioned in our conversation already, and of course you discuss in the book, is the idea of that one, we've understood that we need to bring our productive power, our productive economic power, manufacturing power, to bear in conflicts, particularly if we anticipate a long conflict, say like a World War II. And that seems to be, I'm thinking of a book like Freedom's Forge that talks about American mobilization of American industry during World War II. But it seems to be a common theme and perhaps a common misperception of the adversaries of America, which is that because it's a commercial country, it's not warlike, it can't adapt to war, it's not ready for war. But Americans seem, over time at least, in our way of war, to mobilize the productive resources of the country to direct them at war. And we seem very successful at doing that, at least over time. Talk a little bit about that as a dynamic in the American way of war.
Well, certainly that took place as early as the War of 1812, where we were able to bring a much larger population, 10 times that of Canada, to bear against our adversaries in Canada within a couple of years. Luckily, the British, who had a much larger military, were tied down fighting Napoleon on the continental Europe, which is one of the major reasons why we started the War of 1812 anyway. It was to take advantage of British weakness to try and seize Canada and make use of the resources we had. Second, moving right on to the Civil War, this again was a war that at the beginning, many of the generals said we should be able to win, and many politicians said we should be able to win this on the cheap. And Lincoln found relatively quickly that no, he was going to have to mobilize the people and the industry of the country. And if we had not leaned on the larger population and the larger industrial base of the Union versus the Confederacy, we would be two nations today rather than one United States. This happened in World War One. This happened in World War Two. World War One was not a popular war. It was as unpopular as Vietnam was, but the United States government took over the commanding heights of industry, and it threw a lot of people in jail who were unwilling to go along with the war or were willing to speak out against it. Most famously, Eugene Debs, who was the head of the Socialist Party, and he got a million votes, just about a million votes in two different elections for president. So, and finally, World War II, where more than a third of the economy was mobilized just towards the war. So the United States has been a country where it may not be at its base a warlike country, but it is one that has always repeatedly been able to mobilize its economy and focus it on being able to win.
That's fascinating to me because you in your timeline, you've brought us up to World War II. And one of the things that, of course, looking at your book is striking is it seems to be the consensus view, at least among historians, that the U.S., or at least among in the popular opinion, that the U.S. was sort of always triumphant until 1945. And then we sort of forgot how to win wars, Korea, Vietnam, maybe even the Gulf War, one could argue, and perhaps more recently. But what do you think about that consensus view? And I'm curious to consider, especially given your title, what your book adds to that conversation about this notion that, America won all its wars until 1945, and since then is somehow a big break, and we're fighting war differently since 1945.
Several points come out of that question of yours. First of all, yes, we have historically, before 1945, we suffered several major strategic defeats. Washington, Lincoln, MacArthur, the U.S. Navy at Pearl Harbor, the United States Army, and right after World War II in Korea, the U.S. Air Force over Germany in its bombing campaign was driven from the skies until we brought in the P-51 Mustang that was able to protect our bombers, and we were able to slowly wear down the Luftwaffe. The U.S. has had an amazing experience in such a short period of time in its history of being defeated handily by its opponents and looking like it was going to lose the fight. But every single time we've been able to react and recover and go on to victory. After World War II, yes, of course, we were in more a position of limited war. Of course, nuclear war seemed like one we did not want. It's one that MacArthur wanted in Korea once the Chinese invaded. He actually had asked for atomic weapons, and he wanted to bomb China. And he wanted to cede the northern neck of the Korean Peninsula with radioactive cobalt, create a death zone so nothing could live there for a couple hundred years and the Chinese wouldn't be able to get into the peninsula. Truman decided he didn't want to do that. We didn't want to go that far. We didn't want Northern Korea that badly. We were willing to accept Southern Korea. I would also, and I have the final chapter in the book discusses this concept of, have we been losing all of our recent wars since World War II? And I don't believe that's true. Clearly, Vietnam was a battle, if we want to consider that, that we lost, and arguably the same in Afghanistan and maybe Iraq. But what war were we fighting in Vietnam? We were not there to fight the Vietnam War. We were there fighting the Cold War. And clearly the United States won the Cold War. So while we may have lost a battle strategically and suffered a major defeat in Vietnam, the country did find a way to react, recover, and win the Cold War. And in fact, since Vietnam is now a major trading partner with the United States, American tourists frolic in on the beaches in Da Nang in front of the Four Seasons Hotel. You kind of have to ask, who lost that war? We certainly lost the battle. Did we lose the war? Also, Afghanistan, Iraq. We weren't in Afghanistan to conquer Afghanistan per se. We were there as part of the so-called global war on terror. And at least, knock on wood, to this point, it does seem we have won the global war on terror. If we take a look at goals enunciated by George W. Bush that he wanted to achieve in that war. So I do not believe that 1945 creates a clear break in U.S. military history. Of course, each conflict is a little bit different than the one before it. But in general, the U.S. has consistently found a way, when it's losing on the battlefield, to react, to change what it's doing, to bring in new leadership, to bring in more weapon systems if necessary, stabilize the situation, and we've been able to go on to win.
Before we continue with our conversation, I think it's important to take a moment and tell you about our undergraduate honors program in the liberal arts here at Ashland University.
Hi, I'm Rich Police, Associate Director of Student Programs at the Ashbrook Center. The Ashbrook Scholar Program is an honors program located at Ashland University for undergraduate students with an interest in politics, history, and economics. Modeled after a classical liberal education, you will read the great texts, not textbooks. Your classes will be conversations, not lectures. Conversations with other students, with your professors, and with great thinkers and statesmen from throughout human history. If you or a young person you know are passionate about life's important questions, if you want an education that emphasizes discovery, if you value liberal education and the principles of freedom it upholds, then this is the place for you. To learn more, visit us online at ashbrookscholar.org.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because one of what you just mentioned there, immediately I was thinking about in this adaptation from defeat to victory, the role not only that leadership plays, not only that economic power plays in it, but also that technology plays in it. And technological innovations that are sort of, as they say, war is the mother of invention, right? The necessities of war, the mother of invention. What role has technology played in the American ability to move from initial defeat to ultimate victory?
Sure. It's played a very significant part. It goes all the way back to the Civil War. The Union were able to produce rifled barrels for their guns much more effectively than the South could, both in terms of muskets, which allowed them to fire longer, farther, with better hitting power and more accurately, and also for artillery. And that over time helped wear down the South. It took place, of course, in World War II, where technology advanced in leaps and bounds. The Battle of the Atlantic could have been lost without the invention of sonar, better depth charges, and better use of long-range aircraft, which had to be built right from scratch, along with radar systems on those aircraft to be able to detect things as small as a periscope to find the U-boats. And similarly, that sort of technology was used in the air war above Germany, where we were able to drive the Luftwaffe out of the sky, which allowed D-Day to take place. Finally, even in Vietnam, we definitely did stabilize the battlefield after the Tet Offensive, where the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese suffered horrendous losses, and we were able to move more towards a counterinsurgency strategy, used a lot of technology and air power. And most people remember the end of the Vietnam War as a bunch of helicopters on top of the U.S. embassy with all those people trying to grab hold of the helicopter. But remember, that was in 1975. By 1972, the U.S. had had signed a peace treaty with the Vietnamese, who had accepted, at least temporarily, on the battlefield that they would not continue fighting or invade South Vietnam, and we were able to pull our troops out. The U.S. was supposed to go back into Vietnam if Vietnam ever invaded the South. In 1975, they did. President Ford asked Congress for more assistance. Congress turned him down, and he then had to preside over the fall of Saigon, something that happened, something similar, of course, happened in Afghanistan more recently.
It is fascinating, the role that you alluded to previously, the important role that public opinion plays in the American way of war. Opinion about when to go to war, the opinion about how to fight the war, and the opinion sustaining the public opinion that's necessary to persist in the war. And as you have said, contrary to popular opinion, say, for example, World War I, as you noted, was a very deeply unpopular war with lots of Americans. So there have been struggles through the course of American history in major wars to sustain public opinion in a way that supports the war effort. Talk a little bit more about historically where we've seen public opinion in this American way of war.
This goes back all the way to the founding of the nation. We was discussing Thomas Paine, who was with Washington's army as he was as they were retreating back through New Jersey towards Philadelphia, and public opinion was at a low ebb. There was a real concern that though the Tories, those American colonists who still wanted to remain part of the British Empire, were going to win out, and the Revolution was going to fade away. And it was only after Washington was able to pull off these miraculous victories at Trenton and at Princeton, that in New Jersey, that public opinion soared and recruitment picked up. But not just that, public opinion changed in Europe as well. That's when you got guys like von Steuben and Lafayette boarded ships and came to the United States soon after because of this change in public opinion. Public opinion was extremely important in the Civil War. It was actually a major part of why Lee had invaded into the North, where he was turned back at Antietam and at Gettysburg, because you had, you had a congressional election coming up, and there was a hope that American public interest in the war and not letting the Confederacy go would crack. And luckily, it did not. The Republicans at the time were able to hold on to their power in Congress and the White House, of course, and pursue the war until ultimate victory. So the United States has, for a significant period of its wars, have had to fight both on the battlefield, but also in public opinion back home.
It does strike me when you think about some of the wars that were unpopular versus popular. You know, as you said, World War I and Vietnam were relatively unpopular wars by American standards. World War II was relatively popular. What separates those? My first glance is, well, World War II, we were attacked by the Japanese at Pearl Harbor, and then the Germans, the Nazis, declared war on us. So it seems like we were unjustly brought into the conflict, whereas World War I, a little more ambiguous. Vietnam, again, a little more ambiguous, the Gulf of Tonkin situation and the rest. Is that it? Is it these wars were unpopular and it was hard to sustain public opinion because the origin of the war was not so obviously an injustice against the United States? Or were there other things going on?
Well, that, of course, that is part of it. Is certainly having a couple thousand U.S. Civilian or citizens get killed on the first day of a war, that's going to focus people's attention. But also a lot of it had to do with what people believed in for the American ideal and their sense of their ability to live their lives the way they wanted to live. And in World War I, it was somewhat difficult to understand what was going to be different about Britain and England, or Britain and France winning, versus Austria-Hungary and Germany to the average American. And of course, there were a large percentage of Americans were of Irish descent, who were anti-British or were of German descent and, of course, were ambiguous about going to war with Germany. In World War II, it seemed quite clear that from what the American people had been seeing, from what the Japanese had been doing in China, from what the Germans had been doing in Europe, that these people represented a real threat to the American way of life. And they were more willing to fight for that than they were willing to potentially fight for what seemed to be just the dynamics of one empire versus another trying to gain the upper hand in Europe in the previous war in World War I.
And what about in the Vietnam War? What I know that's been a subject of a lot of controversy among historians, and it's so fresh for a lot of people, even listeners of this podcast will have lived through the Vietnam era. In that particular case, is it the cause of the war, or is it the way the war is fought, the goals of the war? What was the difficulty there in sustaining public opinion?
Well, it was multiple factors, as you mentioned. First of all, if we think about the domino strategy, which is what we were told was the reason we were fighting. Americans were very against communism. That had really always remained in public opinion polls very strong. Americans were willing to fight communism. But the domino theory was first enunciated by President Eisenhower about Indochina, about Vietnam. He didn't say that Vietnam was strategically important to us. He said, but if Vietnam falls, Indochina falls, then we will start to lose strategically important places to us, such as Malaysia and Singapore and the Philippines and maybe even Japan and Indonesia. And the dominoes didn't fall. But remember, Eisenhower was saying this and started giving assistance to the people fighting the communists in Vietnam in 1955. So it wasn't until 1975 that Vietnam fell. And by that time, free markets, faster economic growth, the option, the ability of these countries to interact with the U.S. Consumer market and sell things to the U.S. consumer market had led to their economies booming. And they didn't fall, though communist insurgencies in places like the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia were a real threat for a time until they were defeated while we were fighting in Vietnam. So the concept of Vietnam was well enunciated to the American people, and the American people did not want communism. They wanted to fight against it. But how much blood and treasure were we willing to give up in Vietnam became increasingly contentious as the war dragged on. Just to finish up, I would say the Tet Offensive is usually what people think of when they think of that war. And that was a major strategic defeat for the communists, for the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. They took massive losses during that war. The problem was, it was for the United States, while it was a military victory, it was a strategic defeat for us because it turned many of the American people against the war, including people like Walter Cronkite with a helmet on saying this war cannot be won. But the fact of the matter was, the communists were very much weakened in the years after the Tet Offensive took place.
Of course, in your book, it's a book of history, of military history, of American history, looking backwards at those important moments in American history from the founding through the 20th century. What about looking forward? What's the future of the American way of war?
Well, I hope it can continue to be successful and we're victorious. I would like to hope that we don't have as many defeats going forward. Looking at American history to this point has been, it's exciting, it's interesting. The United States is the Rocky Balboa of world military history. We get knocked down to the canvas a lot and then get back up and win the fight. You know, that made Rocky III a lot more interesting. You know, if Clubber Lane hadn't knocked Rocky Balboa down a few times first, it wouldn't have been that good a movie. Unfortunately, there are real concerns as to whether or not the U.S. is going to suffer another major strategic defeat in our next war against a peer or near peer power, because technologically the world is changing so quickly. And for better or worse, the United States is wedded and spends hundreds of billions of dollars on large legacy weapon systems that may no longer be survivable on the battlefield. I'm talking about big aircraft carriers, big submarines, main battle tanks. Main battle tanks are basically have been retired to a great extent from the war in Ukraine. We've sent our M1 Abrams in there. They can't survive against drones. It's not clear that our aircraft carriers can operate close enough to Taiwan to help protect Taiwan if that conflict becomes a hot war. It's not even clear if our very expensive nuclear attack submarines can continue to operate in the Taiwan area against swarms of underwater drones that the Chinese may be able to deploy. So luckily, it doesn't seem that war is about to break out today. The U.S. seems to be trying to focus on many of the technologies that will dominate the battlefield in the future, and hopefully we will be able to react and recover from what we see taking place in Ukraine and the Middle East today, so we will be ready if we unfortunately have to go to war again.
James, we were discussing the importance of leadership and sort of the American idea that we might not have the right generals at the beginning, but over time, we have military officers up to the rank of general. We get better through being tested in the struggle. In your book, you, of course, document so many of these important, interesting moments in American history where that took place. Is there a person, to your mind, that exemplifies that? You've mentioned General Grant already, but for our listeners who might know, of course, General Washington and General Grant, is there somebody else in your study of these moments where you say, wow, there's a really interesting American figure who rises up to lead Americans to victory?
Well, I'm going to cheat and I'm going to give you two, one from the beginning of U.S. military history and one that's much more recent. First one would be Nathaniel Greene. He realized relatively quickly, and he fought with Washington up north, and then he was fought around Saratoga. He realized that the U.S. militiamen, the Minutemen, could not stand against the British Redcoats and the Hessians, who were professional soldiers, in a pitched battle. And he was able to adapt and make use of what he had to win. And in the Carolinas, when he took over after the U.S. lost not one, not two, but three full field armies, and he was finally sent down to try and recover the states of Georgia and the Carolinas for the United States, which otherwise might have remained British, he learned how to have the militiamen often stand in forward lines, fire two or three shots against the British, and then retreat. And that was planned and discussed so that they would not run away in a rout, and then reform and join the fight again. And this was very successful when Daniel Morgan, under his ultimate command, beat the British at Cowpens, and then where Greene was able to win the battle at Guilford Courthouse. Of course, though, he did say that at Guilford Courthouse, he lost the field of battle, but he won. He lost the field, but he won the battle because Cornwallis just couldn't suffer the losses and couldn't make good as quickly. Then I'll jump forward to World War II to Doolittle. So this was a gentleman who was a famous aviator before World War II, and he was very successful both in the Pacific and the Atlantic. So you may recall that they came up with the idea of loading some medium bombers, some big planes, onto these relatively small aircraft carriers at the time. And they had these planes take off on a one-way trip. They weren't going to have enough fuel to get back to the aircraft carrier to bomb Tokyo. And this was supposed to be our way of getting revenge for Pearl Harbor. And it was our first big strike back. And Doolittle and his men, they lost almost all their planes, and they mostly crashed or crash-landed in China. And it had an immense impact on the war because it forced the Japanese to change their strategy. They were so embarrassed that the emperor had been at risk and could have been bombed. And they ended up attacking the Hawaiian island chain again and losing it Battle of Midway. Then, at the time, right afterwards, Doolittle said that he was as low as a frog's posterior after that that bombing raid. And when he was in China and he was rushed back to the United States, he thought he was going to be relieved. Instead, he was He was given a medal and promoted. He was sent off to Europe. And one thing he did when he took over the 8th Air Force in Britain was the bombers were getting savaged by the Luftwaffe fighters, both the single-engine fighters and larger two-engine fighters that were good at taking out bombers, but were not particularly maneuverable or great in fighting against other fighters. And Doolittle made a decision that he said was very controversial. He knew it was controversial. He knew he was putting his reputation at risk, but he had all of these fighter squadrons range ahead of the bombers and go out and hunt the German fighter planes rather than staying with the bombers and protecting them. And of course, at first, the bomber crews were very unhappy with this concept. Where are our fighters that are supposed to be protecting us? But the result was many more German fighters were shot down, and because the fighters could move faster and they were able to break up the German fighter concentrations in advance of the bombers getting there, the more bombers got through, they dropped their bombs, and more of them got back to fly more missions because of Doolittle's decision. So that would be another person who really was able to think outside the box, make use of the technology we had at the time in new ways, and was able to cause a significant defeat for both the Japanese and the Germans. It's hard to say, come up with anyone else who did that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I hadn't thought about him in that particular light, especially in the European theater. You think about the American way of war in particular, of course, the commander in chief is the president. And obviously, presidents have had some role in the way that Americans fight their wars and the success of those wars. Tell us a little bit about the role of the president, and maybe just take one historical example for us. You say, here's a president who was particularly effective or particularly ineffective as commander-in-chief in leading Americans in war.
Well, I think FDR definitely stands out in his effectiveness. And to a certain extent, he tried to have his allies, the British, the French, the Chinese, and then the Soviets, win World War II without the United States actually having to get involved. But of course, that after Pearl Harbor, that was not going to take place. The biggest decision he made is he was convinced and he went with the concept of a Germany first strategy, which he believed, and most of his high advisors believed as well, that Nazi Germany, with its technological abilities, and if it could gain the industrial might of all of Europe behind it, would threaten the United States long term. Versus Japan, even though they were the ones who attacked us at Pearl Harbor, it was a smaller country with a smaller economy, with not as good technology, and we needed to make sure that Germany lost first rather than Japan. So we were sending most of our war power to Europe rather than across the Pacific to Asia, even though Japan had been the ones that started and grabbed us into the war. Secondly, FDR realized we needed to get involved somewhere in the European conflict on the ground. And Marshall and most of the other U.S. generals were saying we had to put an army in England, land it across in France, and then march on Berlin. We weren't going to be ready to do that for years, and that was too long. So FDR insisted on the torch operation, which was landing U.S. troops in French North Africa. He overruled his Joint Chiefs of Staff. He almost lost some of them to resignations because of it, but he won out. The operation was quite successful. Luckily, the French did not fight back very effectively and quickly changed sides and started fighting with us. And then we went on to achieve with the British a very significant victory in Tunisia, where more Germans surrendered than in the Sixth Army at Stalingrad. And from there, the United States Army, which was not really ready to take on the Germans on its own at that point, gained a lot of experience, which then went into effect and got where we got better and better in Sicily and Italy. And then eventually on D-Day, we were ready to land in France. And much of that success was because of FDR's abilities.
Well, that is a serious, sober, in some ways hopeful, but very thoughtful analysis. And again, the book for our listeners who want to plunge into this very, very interesting, fascinating part of American history. The book, again, is Seeds of Victory, Defeat, Triumph, and the American Way of War by James Ellman. James, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.